When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, and more specifically, or rather more geographically, to Tennis Podcast Towers, Launceston. That's how I'm interpreting the street sign that I recently followed. David, have I got that anywhere near right?
Well, the problem is I live basically here, and I've never heard of it before. So we've taken a turn that I wasn't expecting, and we've ended up on another farm.
Yes, because myself and Matt have come up to David's neck of the woods for... well, for meetings, really, and for recording this podcast, and for... well, this is the time of the year when David offloads the many, many ideas in his head, and we discuss whether any of them are feasible in the real world. And we can't wait, Matt.
I love coming up here for meetings, and I'm just praying that Wednesday's weather forecast doesn't come to fruition, because otherwise we may be in another Shrewsbury flood situation.
Yes.
But David's promised to rescue us in his big car.
Yeah, thoughts and prayers for my Honda Civic over the course of the next few days. We're in a rather more rural location than I was expecting. So rural that we have a group of sheep collecting outside our window. And Billie Jean, who is currently enjoying cuddles from David, has got both eyes firmly fixed on those sheep. So if you do hear any barking over the course of the next hour, you'll know exactly what is going on. Let's move on to the tennis, shall we? And let's start in Doha, where it is a first title of 2024 for world number one, Iga Świątek. It felt all week like she was on a collision course with Elena Rybakina in the final, and so it proved. Świątek beating Rybakina 7-6, 6-2 in that final, with Rybakina having led with a double break 4-1. In the opening set, she took a medical timeout for a Raducanu-esque self-inflicted injury while serving David and kind of derailed herself therein and never quite recovered, kind of allowed Świątek the opportunity to find her feet in the match, find her composure, I suppose, in the conditions. It was an incredibly windy day in Doha, wasn't it? And I do think of Iga Świątek as the best wind player in the world, with those tiny footsteps that she takes. I associate Iga Świątek so closely with squeaky shoes, tiny, tiny squeaks of shoes, trainers on the court, and you could hear that so much in those incredibly windy conditions. And she was a very... deserving, in the end, dare I say, comfortable winner against her old nemesis, Rybakina.
So, certainly in the way she accelerated away in the second set, because that looked so unlikely early on. I mean, this was, for the first five games, a carbon copy of several of their other meetings. This was one player who just came out, seeing the ball big, having the crispest, most beautiful ball strike, the sound of it from Rybakina, and able to deal with the Świątek game. She's sort of whipping the ball in Rybakina's direction with all that topspin on the forehand, and it's having no effect. She's just timing the ball backwards. And she was constantly going cross-court to the Świątek forehand, going fast and deep and darting the ball into that side. And that looked like a real tactic of hers. And Iga couldn't really cope with that for the first five games. And yes, I think that that hitting of the leg and having to have it treated, it wasn't a serious injury, but it took the air out of the balloon for her a little bit. And I think it did discombobulate her a little bit. But perhaps the most interesting part of it was Świątek went over to her coaching team and spoke to her coach for the entirety of that break. And clearly, whatever was said worked. And part of that, she said, I was panicking. I was panicking with what was coming my way, and I wasn't really doing the right things to deal with it. And whatever was said, what felt like came out of it was she just went into scrapper mode. And this is a player who I feel like sometimes comes undone against these big hitters because she doesn't want to be dominated. She wants to do the dominating. She wants to give you all guns blazing. And it's very exciting to watch. And when she's on, she goes and blitzes people one and one. But when somebody stands up to her, she sometimes then goes into an error machine. And this time she didn't. She those little squeaky sounds on the shoes that you're discussing, whilst that's a trademark, it was almost amplified and magnified in this instance because she was just making sure she put those extra steps in to get to the ball, make her play more, go toe-to-toe but in a different way, and eventually just turn the tables. And I actually think that they should both come out of that match feeling pretty good because Rybakina showed that her top level causes problems for Świątek and kind of she should have won, really. She certainly should have won the first set. And yet Świątek turned that around. So I think there's something for them both there.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way of looking at it, actually. I think there really ought to be regrets for Rybakina, quite frankly. She should have won that first set. And I mean, it goes without saying that if she wins that first set, it's a different match. I do think it's a WTA rule, isn't it, that if you draw blood, you have to seek treatment. I rather suspect she would have quite liked to power through. The Billie Jean sound effects you're hearing, by the way, are because I asked David to buy her some treats on the way over because I forgot to bring some. And David bought the most enormous pack of Billie Jean's favourite treats in the world. And they are in her eye line at the moment. And she's like, I know I've already had three, but can I have some more, please? And the answer is no. What was I saying? Rybakina, yes. I rather suspect she would have liked to have carried on and stayed in the zone, but it was a bit alarming and not necessarily the trademark of a top, top player, how the bubble burst after that time, how she wasn't able to regroup very quickly. And I do think she really let Świątek off the hook. She lost her three times last year, Świątek. She is in her head. She's a double breakdown. She's on the ropes. She's mentally spiraling. You've got to put your foot down. You've got to stamp on her at that point. And she did the exact opposite. And that should be a regret and is a bit of a mental worry for Rybakina. But I agree, tennis-wise, I still felt like Rybakina, when she's on, that game is a problem for Świątek. And I do think perhaps part of the reason she's panicking is because she's come into this season with with changes to her game that are specifically designed to combat Rybakina and maybe to a slightly lesser extent Ostapenko. But those kinds of players, and I think particularly Rybakina, because Rybakina is somebody that she's probably going to be expecting to play in a lot of her biggest matches of this year, and of course Sabalenka as well. So I think kind of positives for both is a very good way of looking at it.
I think Świątek against big hitters is going to be such a just fascinating part of her career. Like, I remember thinking after she beat Collins at the Australian Open how important that felt. And then the next match, she goes and loses to Noskova, who's hitting hard and flat. And it was like, oh, well, you can't just solve it in a match. Like, I think it is always going to be there. But I think it's just really important that she won this one against kind of her biggest rival in that matchup, that head-to-head anyway, because everything else was in her favour here, like the wind, best player in the wind, see Cancun, of how she dealt with those conditions so much better than everyone else. I always think of Świątek in finals. That's kind of the best Świątek as well. She's got such a good record. And Doha is like, she's won it 3 times in a row. Everything was aligned for her. If she hadn't beaten Rybakina in those conditions, it would have kind of been like, well, when is she going to beat Rybakina? So I just think little by little, she's getting better against these big hitters. You know, like, as you've described, that patience that she showed, that composure was way different to what she showed against Ostapenko at the US Open last year. Her sort of commitment to defend and scrap and get behind the ball and all of that, I think, is improving. But had she taken a loss there, I think that would have been real scar tissue. So I think it's massive for Świątek that she won this. I think we can write it off as, oh, just Świątek winning Doha again. But like the manner of it, beating Rybakina, I think's big. But at the same time, as you said, Rybakina, it's not like she's lost her advantage in that head-to-head against Świątek. Like she has still got the game to cause her problems. So it just sort of all goes back to what we're always saying. We just want these players to keep playing each other because we just learn a little bit more every time. I just love it.
Yeah, a more important win for Świątek than for Rybakina, I think.
Yes.
And still a fantastic week for Rybakina overall. I mean, still a week that leaves you wondering what on earth happened in Melbourne to Anna Blinkova. And I was actually discussing that with my brother this week. This was before the final. He said, "Tell me Rybakina's not going to win Wimbledon." And I was like, "I can't. She's surely the favourite for Wimbledon." And then I went, "Oh, but the Australian Open just makes me think." Just puts that asterisk in my mind. But then sometimes weird anomalous things that you can't really draw any patterns or conclusions from do happen, and that's not good trade for tennis podcasters, is it, to just say there's a thing that happened, can't tell you anything about it or tell you what it means, it's just a thing that happened. But that sometimes is the case, and it's more often the case in women's tennis for, I think, two main reasons. Number one, they play best of three sets at Grand Slams, and there just is more variance in best of three set matches. And number two, I think menstruation makes it more likely that you're going to have the odd freak result. I've got no idea what's going on with Elena Rybakina, whether it's her time of the month in Australia. I'm just making a general point about the fact that, again, I don't know why I'm saying this, given it's such bad trade for tennis podcasters, but sometimes weird things do happen. I find myself just going around in circles in my brain thinking, but what does it mean? And going, it doesn't have to mean anything.
The thing is, I think that is a really important reminder for me and for probably a lot of people listening. Not everybody. There's a lot of people who probably think, the same as you, I don't know whether that's a factor. It may not be one at all, but it may be one. And it is a factor that women have to deal with that men don't. And actually, I don't think it's a bad thing at all to just remind us ourselves once in a while not to just draw some lazy conclusion based on every condition being equal, because they're not always, are they? And it can be that, it can be other things, but yeah, I mean, she didn't look in Australia, in Melbourne, like she has either side of it, apart from Adelaide, when she was also terrible. But you know, and listen, that may be the outstanding thing that she just needs to not do again. But generally speaking, it's a bit like Ostapenko against everybody except Azarenka. It's just Rybakina's form has been awesome either side.
Other things from Doha. This has all just been biding time, by the way, before we can talk about the Ostapenko-Azarenka handshake. Before we get on to that, should we talk about Pliskova? Because you guys got really into the Pliskova story this week. The Cluj to Doha dash.
Yeah, that's a very good little pithy way of putting it.
Well, it was It was pretty remarkable, actually. Like, I think it might be the most I've ever been into Karolina Pliskova this past week. You know, not a player who, you know, I respect the hell out of her career. She had an amazing career, you know, in terms of getting to number one and winning so many titles. But, you know, her brand of tennis, to be honest, has never excited me. But I found myself absolutely sort of glued to her story this week, because it wasn't just that she'd gone all the way from Cluj to Doha and by the way landed on the morning of her first match in Doha. She landed, I think got a quick bit of sleep and then played her match that evening. But it was the manner of her wins. Like, she was a set down twice and came back to win, won another three-setter as well, beat Naomi Osaka in two tie breaks, a really high quality match. It was just really impressive resilience. It was almost like she had a bit of a point to prove. Like, she was just gonna say, "Look, I'm gonna push myself to the absolute extreme here. Everyone's writing me off because how can I possibly win this match? I've had no preparation." And yet she just kept doing it. And I found it really impressive. And honestly, in the last couple of weeks, she's pretty much halved her ranking, I think. Won a title. I think, we're seeing the benefits of dropping down a level and winning a load of matches. She was winning matches based, I think, on confidence and feelings of getting a lot of wins recently. It was helping her over the line when she didn't necessarily have her best tennis. But it was just pretty remarkable, actually. Like, a shame and perhaps inevitable that she did eventually just run out of steam and had to withdraw, didn't she, ahead of her semi-final that would have been against Świątek. And that was a real shame, you know. And the point is, the tennis schedule shouldn't punish people for doing so well one week and compromising them the next week. You know, that was a shame, and there's a bigger talking point there. But, like, she made the most of the matches that she did play in Doha, and it was very impressive.
I think Naomi Osaka would quite like to not face Karolina Pliskova again for a while, because that's the second time this year she's lost out to her, and it was kind of felt like quite a similar match, like close but just not close enough
and high level.
Yeah,
like, again, like, both teeing off on the ball, and there was a moment towards the end where Osaka started saving so many match points, and I was reminded of, you know, all the times she's done that previously, and you thought, is she gonna do it again? Is she gonna get out of jail in this match and go on to win it? But honestly, Pliskova was too relentless and too good. But there were good signs for Osaka in Doha. It was her best tournament so far, I would say. That it was kind of a shame for her that she didn't get to play. I think it was her last 16
against Serenko.
She doesn't need walkovers right now. No. She needs matches.
So it's the big problem about coming back is you can very easily end up playing 4 weeks in a row and playing four really good players and just getting no real match routine. And I think this was quite a good step in the right direction. She sort of felt like she was part of the tournament, part of the tour during this week. And I agree, of the Serenko match, I think she probably would have won that. And that's another bit in the tank, isn't it? Mm. It's that bit of match toughness and everything else. But I was encouraged. I didn't see the first match she played against Pliskova at the start of the year, but she was right in this one, and it could have turned.
Am I right that she's not playing Dubai
this week? She pulled out of Dubai during her run in Doha. Yeah.
Fair enough.
I misheard that, by the way, you know, at the time. I remember during that match they're saying she can go full out and know that this is the only tournament she's going to play because she's not playing Dubai. I thought they meant Pliskova at the time. and I'm just assuming that because Pliskova's had this ridiculous run, you know, and then she withdraws because of injury in the next match. And here she is.
I think Pliskova is playing Dubai.
Yeah, she's already won a match.
And I'm like, hold on a minute, I thought she pulled out. I'd got the wrong player.
Look, when you're on a roll, David. Right, we have arrived at destination, folks. Yelena Ostapenko has still only lost to one player in 2024, and she's done that three times. She has lost once again to Victoria Azarenka. Now, I commentated Ostapenko's second loss of 2024 to Azarenka, and that was in the third round of the Australian Open. And it was a tense match. It was clearly a match between two players that didn't have too much warmth for one another. But I have to say the handshake disappointed me on that occasion. In fact, I would say the general level of aggro disappointed me. It was just a sort of quite low quality tennis match with sort of a simmering level of tension that never boiled over into anything funny. Well, turns out they were just saving themselves for the, or rather Ostapenko was saving herself for the handshake in their match in Doha, which was once again won by Victoria Azarenka. Would somebody like to describe, perhaps professional radio commentator David Law to my left, what Yelena Ostapenko did in lieu of a handshake?
Well, it got better on the third watch, I felt, because my first watch of it, so I knew it was going to be something special because of the way it had been going along. I mean, Ostapenko's getting an absolute hammering in the first set. The second set's really close, but Azarenka wins again. And just the body language of Ostapenko and the reactions to the body language from Azarenka throughout the match had told me where this is going. And it's just, how severe is it going to get? You know, I've had you two reenact an Ostapenko handshake at Wimbledon of the sort of no-look variety, barely putting the palm up. Well, this one was worse because she walks to the net, she gets there first, and she quite dramatically just points her racket frame in the direction of Azarenka, like they used to do 4 years ago during the height of the pandemic when you're not allowed to shake hands. and Azarenka, and I thought that was the handshake until I went back for a second viewing and realised that Azarenka, upon seeing this outstretched racket, just stopped and looked incredulous and sort of went, "Oh, forget this," and just walked off and didn't even try to tap the racket.
Act three is Ostapenko like rolling her eyes as if it was Azarenka's act of aggression, like, "Oh, well, she's refusing to shake my hand then," looking indignant. It was 5 seconds of pure entertainment.
Yeah, it's the perfect aggro sweet spot, because it is not horrifically unpleasant and unpalatable, but it is just wonderfully childish and silly and funny.
Yeah, it's just utterly pathetic, isn't it? So good.
Something that I'm also finding really funny about this Azarenka-Ostapenko 2024 rivalry is that Azarenka has lost her next match every time after beating Ostapenko. It's not like she's in title-winning form. She's just in Ostapenko-beating form.
And isn't it just a perfect example of how styles impact matches? Because we've seen Ostapenko smash Iga Świątek off the court several times. And we've seen Azarenka absorb the game of Ostapenko every time and manage to beat her. And quite often, Azarenka, when she faces Świątek, as she did in the very next match, couldn't get nearer, really. I mean, I think the first set was close. But, you know, it's just one of those things. And Azarenka knows how to absorb that game.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a beautiful illustration of that head-to-head. The WTA Tour moves on to Dubai this week. It's another 1,000 event, and it is Aryna Sabalenka's hotly anticipated return to competition after winning the Australian Open. Ostapenko and Azarenka in different halves of the Dubai draws. If they're to meet again,
looking forward
will
to that
be
final.
In the final. Jabeur is out of Dubai. That knee injury that we discussed last week from Doha, that's keeping her out of Dubai.
Glad she's pulled out. As sad as I am for her, it would have been so tempting to just play. Particularly there, I think, and in that part of the world, and I think it's important that she tries to get to the bottom of this.
Or did we discuss it last week?
Yeah, we did.
Was that a private? We did.
How upset she looked on the court, and again, you're not 100% sure what that's in relation to, but there were some quotes from her about the knee sometimes being a problem, and you know, it's important for her because as much as she wants to play well there, her goals have to be higher than that. And she ain't going to reach them if she's in any way 100%, not 100% fit.
Krejcikova, defending champion, is also out of Dubai with back injury. That's tough for her, isn't it? I kind of feel like, just feel like it's a bit tough being Barbora Krejcikova at the moment, you know?
Can't really get a fair crack at it. Because I get this feeling she's come out at the start this year really wanting to get back amongst it.
And she said it was Siniakova's decision, hasn't she?
Yes.
The doubles split. Mm.
Yeah.
And makes me sad.
Incidentally, Siniakova had a good win, didn't she, in Doha, beat Coco Gauff.
Mm. Yeah,
Although
that was
was poor.
Yeah, Gauff really was poor. It was, you know, rinse and repeat of, you know, when Gauff loses matches, apart from to Sabalenka at the Australian Open, that does tend to be what they look like when she loses. You know, the forehand fell apart, quite frankly, and it was picked apart. And yeah, it looked pretty bad. But I also really don't doubt her ability and probability of just completely bouncing back and being as resilient as ever and not letting it rock her. So that is the WTA tour for last week, and looking ahead to this week, the ATP tour has been in three different destinations. 500 event in Rotterdam, won by Jannik Sinner, unbeaten in 2024, beat Alex de Minaur 7-5, 6-4. He's always beating poor Alex de Minaur, isn't he?
It 7 out of 7, I think?
Yeah, and three of them very recent. This, I think, Matt, for you, de Minaur's best loss against Jannik Sinner.
I think so. I think he did win a set against Sinner, but, you know, several years ago. Certainly of the recent ones, this was de Minaur's best display. And, you know, it's tricky, isn't it? Because de Minaur is, you know, he's top 10 player in the world now. He's such an elite player. It's almost a bit patronising to say, oh, you did a great job, Alex. But I really do think that he did. I thought he was brilliant in this match. And kind of the best thing I can say, I guess, is that it didn't feel like to me that he was a worse player than Jannik Sinner in this match. Like, I didn't look at it and obviously think that there was a huge matchup problem. It was a really close tennis match. There was 3 points in it in terms of, you know, 79-76 it was at the end. It was so close. He just felt like a worse big match player. Or maybe Jannik Sinner felt like a better big match player, you know, because all the key moments right at the end of the first set where Sinner's been a breakup and de Minaur breaks him back, 15-minute game, Jannik Sinner ends up sprawled on the court and you think, right, momentum can shift here. It didn't. And it was exactly the sort of thing that I would have probably said about if someone was playing Novak Djokovic, when you think you're going to get the momentum on your side and you don't. And Sinner meant that was the case. He just broke back in the next game and then served it out. And he did similarly in the second set when de Minaur broke. He just broke him in the very next game. It was little moments like that. Sinner, who I don't think didn't have his best level in any of his matches, I would say, in Rotterdam, but he's raised his floor, hasn't he? And he's got playing with so much confidence. He can manage matches now. He doesn't panic. And he rode out a lot of big moments, and he looked like a player who has just leveled up and is now a Grand Slam champion and has learnt to win without his best. And yeah, it was deeply, deeply impressive. He's the first maiden male Grand Slam champion since Leighton Hewitt to win their next tournament after playing a slam. And incidentally, I think Darren Cahill is coach of both of those.
That's a great start. I mean, it's
telling.
It feels impressive. It feels that doesn't surprise me when I hear it, because that's how it feels. You know, like that is a big deal to go and back that up.
Yeah.
I mean, winning, not playing your best, winning matches and by extension winning titles when you're not playing your best is such an important developmental stage for top players, isn't it? Because how many of Djokovic's slams has he won playing his best? Not many. Not many.
Certainly more recently.
And
if
you're going to rack them up, like, I wouldn't expect you to win your, unless you're Coco Gauff, your first Grand Slam, that's probably you playing lights out. But that's part of the evolution of a tennis player, isn't it? That you just sort of become a winning machine. Yeah. You win the right points rather than sort of, as you said about the de Minaur match, in terms of the numbers, it was all but even. And, it's something that Sinner has nailed in a way that Alcaraz hasn't. I mean, not quite winning ugly, but winning not playing your best. Alcaraz
efficiently.
We'll come on to talk about Alcaraz and, of course, Nicholas Jarry in a moment. but Yannick Sinner has got an edge in that department on Carlos Alcaraz. I still believe Alcaraz's top level is higher, but I don't think you win much with your top level.
Well, isn't there a comparison there between, when you talk of the big three, probably people spend more time exclaiming about shots played by Roger Federer and Rafael Nadal, and yet Novak Djokovic has won more than them both. And here we have very embryonic stages, but we have somebody we jump out of our seats watching more often in Carlos Alcaraz. And yes, at the moment, he's won two Grand Slams, Sinner's won one. But which one of them feels like the more mature, professional, sports person, winning machine? I know people rail against me for saying the word professional, but I think that there is something to that about just that absolute last degree to which Djokovic and Sinner find ways and know when to raise it and know when to knuckle down and not miss. Mm. And I just think that Sinner is, of all the players out there, is learning the Novak Djokovic recipe.
Mm. We will come on to Buenos Aires and Alcaraz and the other key results there in a moment. But first, Matt, you've put Talon Griekspoor in the agenda. This is you have the floor to talk about Talon Griekspoor.
Well, I was just going to quickly say on Alex de Minaur, like, I know we've talked about that loss there that he took against Sinner, but he had a great week in terms of beating Rublev and Dimitrov back to back. And I just think, I always used to think de Minaur had such a ceiling, and he is now, okay, not Yannick Sinner, but he is regularly beating so many of the other top players.
He's doing what Sinner does, but at a slightly lower level.
Mm. Yeah, I'm just really impressed. I think we talk about, we've spoken about Dimitrov sort of understanding his own game better. I think de Minaur is understanding his game and when to counterpunch and defend versus when to attack more. And he's getting so much more out of his serve. He's just a way better player than he used to be. And I just think that's worth noting. Like, he's doing,
his serve is doing so improved.
Well. It is.
Improved.
Like, again, he lost the baseline rallies against Rublev. And if you'd said, how does Alex de Minaur win tennis matches if he's not winning the baseline rallies a couple of years ago? You just wouldn't have thought it possible, but he's getting cheap points now. And
I think that emboldens him to be a bit more aggressive with the rest of his game, right? The fact that he's getting more cheap points, I think, makes him feel like he can take a few more risks.
Yeah. And he's got a lovely slice backhand as well. Like, it's really good from Alex de Minaur right now. And yeah, I've put off talking about Talon Griekspoor long enough. He had a good week. Like, he's really good at home. Really good in the Netherlands. He's got I think he's won 14 of his last 16 matches at home, and the two losses have been to Yannick Sinner in
Dutch
the Rotterdam
semis.
Dutch
players are good at home, aren't they? Remember Tim van Rijthoven?
Yeah.
Well, and Rotterdam is a fantastic tournament.
It is.
It's got, what is it, decades of history. I first went there in 2002. You know, it's 22 years ago. It'd already been going about 30 years at that point. But I think they are super motivated to play well at home, and the conditions, I think, suit their game. It's what they come up playing on a lot of the time. the scorelines of those first two matches were what made me think, oh, Talon Griekspoor is absolutely somebody we should talk about here. I mean, they're incredible.
It was 7-6 in the third against both Mazzetti, and then he beat Hurkacz, didn't he? And Hurkacz indoors is like a nightmare.
Both are set down, and both of them 7-6, 7-6 after that.
Yeah. I was a little bit... I was expecting more from him in a way in the semi-final, and that might sound incredibly harsh because he's playing Jannik Sinner, but I didn't think he quite brought it in that semi-final. I really thought that would be a tough match for Sinner, and Sinner kind of really took care of him easily. He's had a good week there, and kind of unfortunately for him, he got to the semis last year, as I said, so he hasn't actually sort of gained a load of points. It almost feels like he's put in a lot there. He's beaten Hurkacz, and he's not actually going to gain loads in the ranking. Like, he needs to keep doing it elsewhere.
That must be such a bummer for a tennis player, you've had an all-time week and all you've done is stood still.
Yeah. I still don't feel like I completely know what he is as a player yet, and yet sometimes he can get good wins. I'd like to see... It's a bit... It's not quite Hugo Gaston outside of France, but I want to see him go elsewhere and do it now.
Outside of Paris.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life, and of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
Now, speaking of great weeks on home soil, how about Facundo Diaz Acosta, who has won the Buenos Aires title? And he's only done it the hard way by beating Nicolas Jarry in the final. 6-3, 6-4. Jarry following up from the biggest win of his career over Carlos Alcaraz in the semi-final. Couldn't back it up in the final. It's a tight turnaround, isn't it, kind of emotionally and physically. But Diaz Acosta, I had a message from my dad whilst watching this final, and it was vibe central, this final. It was, a lot of people would have tuned in, sorry Matt, and gone, who the hell are these two? But I think very quickly, just the vibes and the atmosphere would have pulled you in. And quite honestly, it's the sort of match where if you didn't have the vibes in the atmosphere, a lot of people would just turn off. But it just reeled you in with such a great watch. And Matt, my dad is dying for all the information you have on Facundo Diaz Acosta, and I'm sure he's not alone.
Yeah, it's amazing how, like, I don't think tennis makes the most of its South American swing. I don't, you know, I think there should be a Masters 1000 there, but South America makes the most of the tennis that it's got. Like, they show up for all these events and the atmospheres are brilliant. And, you know, David was describing the Cordoba final last week, and, you know, that was by no means household names in that two qualifiers, and yet amazing scenes. And here in Buenos Aires as well, even without Carlos Alcaraz, they had this kind of, the enemy was Nicolas Jarry from Chile against the home favourite, Facundo Diaz Acosta. And it was fantastic. And honestly, he came to my attention for the first time at the Australian Open this year because he played Taylor Fritz in the first round. And that was a five-setter. And I remember at the time we talked a lot about Taylor Fritz. You know, it was, we saw that match from his perspective and how he has all these problems in the first round of Grand Slams, and, you know, other top players won't get themselves involved in a five-setter against Facundo Diaz Acosta. And we were probably a little dismissive. And yet I went back to read Taylor Fritz's transcript after that match, and he was telling everyone, watch out for this guy, Diaz Acosta. Just going to read what he said. He said, a lot of people are going to look at that score and think that I'm out of form and not playing great. But there needs to be some respect given to this guy. He's really good, honestly. I told him that at the net. I shook his hand and I said, you're really effing good. He was returning serves that I feel like nobody else, unless they full-on guess, would return. He wasn't even picking sides. I was hitting bombs and he was returning them. I've never seen anything like it. So, like, really high praise there from Taylor Fritz. And, you know, he's got a wild card into this event, Diaz Acosta. And it's just an incredibly impressive run to the title. He's beaten Altmaier, who beat Sinner at the French Open last year. He's beaten Francisco Cerúndolo, who is a, you know, top 30, very good clay court player.
The best Cerúndolo.
By far.
Who's having a tough year, by the way.
He is,
did you see that heartfelt post he put out about what a tough time he's having?
Yeah. He's not peak Cerúndolo at the moment. But
it's still a good win. Yeah.
Lajovic, very good clay court player, pushed Alcaraz on clay a lot last year. Correa, not the best Correa, admittedly.
But he was on a run.
Still a good clay courter. Yeah. And then Nicolas Jarry, who is, you know, fresh off beating Carlos Alcaraz. And he's beaten them all in straight sets. And look, Nicolas Jarry did not play well in that final at all. But it was love 40 he had on, in the very first game, Jarry had love 40 on Diaz Acosta's serve. And I thought, wow, Diaz Acosta playing his first final in front of his home crowd, this is going to be kind of tough for him. But he got through that service game. And after that, it looked like he was sort of born to play these sorts of events. You know, he was lapping up the crowd. He made Jarry look slow and lumbering, and he was reading the play, and it was a real effort to get over the line. I think it took him six match points to get there eventually, and it was still pretty nip and tuck. But honestly, what a story. He'd only had two ATP wins before, and he gets five in a week and wins his first title. Like, pretty special scenes, because, as I said, he's from Buenos Aires as well, and the crowd are really appreciating it. And yeah, there's just so much heart and soul in these events, and he was providing a lot of that. It was special scenes.
Yeah, because he's not out of nowhere, is he? He's 23. He's been a challenger player basically, and this propels him. It kind of leapfrogs him over the nether zone, doesn't it? If sort of deciding whether to play challenges or try and play qualifying for the bigger ATP events, he should be getting direct entry now inside the world's top 60 for a while at least into the bigger events. And yeah, we always talk about that sort of that black hole zone that you can get stuck in, sort of 80 to 120 in the world ish. But he's kind of through that tunnel now, and he's got a platform to work with. So we'll see.
Yeah, like, no one's going to want him to be unseeded at the French Open and you run into him in the first or second round as like a top player.
Yeah, he's one of those players that all the top players will be willing on. Like, get inside the world's top 32, please, because yeah, I don't want to draw you.
Yeah.
Definitely Taylor Fritz is thinking that. Now then, Nicolas Jarry's defeat of Carlos Alcaraz in the semi-finals. First of all, Matt Roberts, your floor to talk about Nicolas Jarry.
Someone tweeted me saying, this match is so Matt Roberts coded, because it was Jarry Alcaraz. And I was like, yes. Look, Jarry, who actually we'd sort of been talking about and slightly joking, actually hadn't had a brilliant start to the season. Like, I didn't actually think he was playing all that well, and even his prior wins, it was 7-6 in the third against Wawrinka, and then he got through via retirement from Echeverry in the previous round. Like, I didn't see this performance coming, but he was brilliant against Carlos Alcaraz. It's such an interesting approach to clay court tennis, because it's big serving, you know, hitting the lines with that serve, big flat hits, trying to come forward as much as he can. It's not your typical clay court style, but I love the way he imposes himself. And he did show little bits of nice dexterity and good movement and hand skills. And look, he was brilliant. And I think he handled it well, because the crowd were desperate for Alcaraz to win, and they were doing their absolute best to pull Alcaraz back into this match. And there were little moments towards the end where Jarry was getting a bit tight. He hadn't double faulted all match, and then trying to serve it out, he double faults twice, and you're thinking, oh, Nicolas, don't do this. But he held it together. But sort of the other side of it was, this was not good from Carlos Alcaraz.
It wasn't good from Carlos Alcaraz. It really was. And it was, you know, not in such a dramatic way as against Zverev at the Australian Open, but it was the same sort of flavour of performance, just looking a bit clueless as to what to do. Like, if it's not there for him, it's like he's just sort of waiting for it to come. Not, that makes him sound passive. I mean, obviously he's trying his heart out, but is he trying with a plan? It all looks listless and a bit dumb. Like, it just looks a bit like, what's your plan, Carlos? And look, he's 20 years old, he's figuring it out, he's so bloody good. I'm quite sure he will, but I don't know, it's a bit disconcerting seeing him like that. And I do just worry that he's such an instinctive tennis player, and like, not as we talked about after the Zverev match at the Australian Open, some players are more tactical than others. Like, there's different brands of tennis. He's a very, very, very instinctive tennis player. He feels things on the court, and his instincts are incredible. A lot of people have to play more patterned meat and potato style tennis because they don't have the instincts that Carlos Alcaraz has. That's a wonderful thing. It's one of the things we like about him, but I just worry about him if he keeps suffering setbacks and losses, and his trust in those instincts starts to waver. I worry where that leaves him. I just think he needs to have conviction in his whole body to be able to play the type of tennis that he plays. And I worry about these wounds accumulating and what that does to the particular type of tennis he plays.
I think it's a fair point. The word reliable is not a very sexy tennis word, but that's what Jannik Sinner is, and it's bloody effective. And I'm afraid, from Alcaraz's perspective, his game doesn't feel very reliable at the moment. You don't really know what's coming from it from one game to the next. And he is the most exciting player in the world for me, but that isn't a recipe for guaranteed success all the time. And he's going to have to work some stuff out, I think.
Have you either of you ever seen such a big gap between floor and ceiling in a Grand Slam champion?
Ostapenko.
Touche, Matt.
That's very good.
Touche.
Yeah, there aren't many that have just completely won a Grand Slam, taken it by storm. Now, he's better than that because he's done it twice, and he's faced down Novak Djokovic at Wimbledon and outlasted him and done it there. So he's clearly got it. He's not just coming out blitzing people and that being that. But I'd be very interested to know. I actually thought about trying to do it as a bit of research for this particular podcast, but certainly one for the future. I didn't have time for this one. To speak to some coaches, probably off the record, and find out, are there things that the locker room is starting to learn about how to take this guy on? Because he didn't suffer these sort of losses in the first year that he really came to prominence, when he nearly beat Berrettini at the Australian, when he won Madrid, when he won Miami, when he came into the French Open feeling like the favourite in many ways. In that spring, 2 years ago, these sort of defeats weren't really happening. And I just feel like maybe that's... people have started to think, oh, do you know what you need to do against Alcaraz? It's this. Mm. And maybe they all know. And I still think he's going to end up figuring ways out to overcome that. But I wonder whether that is a thing.
And I do think if you look at his recent losses, there has been a little trend of sort of game style wise. Like, Zverev is not that different to Jarry in terms of, like, they were both hitting big and hard up the middle. And I think Safiulin beat him last year as well, didn't he, towards the end of the year? Like, he's a big ball striker as well. And I remember when Djokovic played Alcaraz at the ATP Finals, he was going big on his forehand. Like, I think rushing Alcaraz is something that you can do right now. The slow starts are a real trend. Like, that's a problem for Alcaraz right now. And he sort of spoke about it after the match in his press conference, and he was talking about it in terms of his concentration. He thinks his concentration is a problem on court right now, and he says it has been for a little while. And it's not like he's losing these matches without showing any glimpses at all. Like, I can point to all these losses, and there've been little moments of Alcarazing in all of them. Even against Jarry, he did a remarkable lob at one point, and a remarkable sort of forehand volley winner from the baseline that just no one else would play that shot, and he hit it for a winner. And you think that's what, you know, he's capable of. But as you said, being able to play more reliable tennis would be sort of perhaps more efficient at this stage. But like, he's so good, and he has so much runway ahead of him. Like, I remain not worried about Carlos Alcaraz long term. I genuinely think this is just a period in his career that he's going through, and I think he's going to win so many more big tournaments. But I do wonder whether he's so ravenous, and he's got such high expectations of himself, and in a way that's one of his greatest strengths, isn't it? But I do think maybe he does need to be a little bit more methodical and reliable and think one tournament at a time rather than...
talking about world number one.
Right.
Every 5 minutes.
You know, and that's...
He's like, gone back to his old haircut, hasn't he? Maybe that's the start of the back to basics.
I like that.
Energy.
We get so excited about his game. I think he gets excited about his own game and his own potential. And it's almost like you want to keep that and bottle that, but also... rein it in a way. And look, he's basically got the same draw in Rio this week. It's all the same players.
It's sort of the same. It's like Adelaide 1 and 2 yeah. all over again, except it is two different countries and cities.
It's now a 500. It's now in Rio. But it's like, put that behind you, Carlos, and go and play that tournament again, but in Rio this time. And look, if it keeps happening, I suppose I will have to eventually get concerned. But right now, I think... personally, I'm still on board the Alcaraz hype train. I mean, I think we all are.
Not too much time left to talk about Delray Beach, but no matter, really, because the final has not yet been played. As we record this at 5 p.m. UK time on Monday, Delray Beach has had to postpone its final due to rain. Torrential rain. They made a very early call in Delray Beach. They obviously saw an extremely threatening looking weather radar and decided there was zero prospect of getting the final played. And they made a very bold and I think very good early decisive call to cancel this final postpone it till Monday between Taylor Fritz and Tommy Paul. Tommy Paul going for the Dallas Del Rey double. So we'll cover that one in next week's show. I think the only thing I think perhaps we should pick up on from Delray Beach is Francis Tiafoe. He lost out to Tommy Paul, a match I watched, and I was really quite shocked at how bad Francis Tiafoe was. And I didn't go in with brilliantly high expectations. I was tuning into that because I wanted, I was feeling a bit weird about where Francis Tiafoe was at right now. And I wasn't necessarily expecting him to win that match, playing against a guy extremely high on confidence on a roll in Tommy Paul. But I think you watched it as well, Matt, didn't you? It was the nature of the loss. It was bad from Francis Tiafoe. I mean, it's like... to think the vibes that he was emitting into the world 18 months ago, I remember interviewing him on the eve of Queens last year, and he just wanted to be in his orbit somehow. It feels like maybe being in his orbit just now is pretty tough, actually. And I know, look, he's got that famously unorthodox technique, hasn't he? Which, when it's not going well, is going to look kind of particularly scratchy, I think, because it's not, I mean, I actually find it really compelling to watch that technique and how effective it can be, but it is, it's not typically beautiful, and when it's bad, it looks bad. But it's more just the energy around him. I feel like his aura has changed colour, and not in a good way. If he was wearing one of those mood rings that Matt probably doesn't know about, because that's a reference from like the 90s. Do you remember the mood rings, David?
Can't say I do.
They supposedly changed colour to indicate your mood, but actually I think they were just heat, heat sensitive. But yeah, I feel like his mood ring is a murky colour right now.
Yeah, like how can it be the same guy who we saw at the US Open a couple of years ago? Like the most electric guy in tennis at the time, certainly in New York. And I mean, he is at this slightly odd stage in his career where the adulation and the attention that he has received isn't matched by his resume. He's getting huge amounts of attention and endorsements, and he's a big part of Breakpoint and all that, and yet he will know himself that he hasn't sort of achieve the things that would necessarily get you that level of stardom, I suppose. And there is just this slight discrepancy. And look, it's been rough for a while. I must say, I tuned into this match, I wasn't shocked by Tiafoe's level. Like, that's the Tiafoe now that I've come to expect. And yeah, it's really tough. He's got this curiously bad record as well against fellow Americans. He's lost his last six against Fritz, his last three against Paul. He lost that US Open quarterfinal to Shelton. He lost to Garone last week in Dallas. He lost his last match to Korda. Like, guy who's meant to be kind of certainly the most exhilarating and exciting out of that crop of Americans who are his age, Opelka, Paul and Fritz. Tiafoe's he's the vibes guy, isn't he? When he comes up against them, he's struggling. And yeah, it's really tough. He's obviously split with Wayne Ferreira at the end of the year. We've gone back to a coach that he used to work with during his USTA days. Yeah, like really tough right now.
Speaking of coaching splits, Tom Hill and Maria Sakkari are no more. Some very heartfelt Instagram posts from them. They've always obviously had a tremendous amount of success together, and their coaching partnership was covered a lot, wasn't it, in series one of Breakpoint in particular. And it's clear the respect and affection that they have for one another, and the comfort zone they created together. And I know there's a lot to be said for that, but equally my interpretation from the outside was that perhaps the line between comfort zone and codependence was being crossed. And look, I want Maria Sakkari to get the best out of her career. I desperately do want the best for her because I know how much she wants it. Look, this might end up not being a productive decision. It might not lead to better results. I don't know, but I do think she has to try and see. I think it's the right decision at this stage of her career for her to do something bold and take a risk.
Yeah, I think so too. And it kind of the same feeling I had a week ago when we were talking about Jessica Pegula finishing with David Witt. That one came out of the blue a bit. But when you think of the record, they're not going to retire right now quite with what they would want to have achieved. Even though I think certainly Pegula has actually done better than maybe people thought she would as a younger player. Sakkari, I think there's been more hype over. There's been more expectation. And they've both had success, but I don't think that they would retire happy with what they've done yet. And unless you turn that stone over and try something else, how are you going to know?
And Pegula, incidentally, is we've heard this week that she's been doing with some work with Andy Roddick, like Coco Gauff did on her serve in the off season. So Andy Roddick is now a sort of jobbing consultant coach, David. If you need some tips,
yeah, yes,
how to get the serve
Andy,
over the net,
come and help.
My serve is bouncing before the net. What do I do?
Something that he was talking about on his podcast last week, and he actually said that
he's not promoting our podcast. Hey, what are we doing?
I mean, he said that it's Lindsay Davenport who is sparking all of these conversations because she's now the Billie Jean. I was trying to think, how is she involved? And then, of course, she's the Billie Jean King Cup captain, and she's out there for all the American players, and she's just sending these players the way of Andy Roddick, who I think is just chuffed, really, to be back involved and not have to do it in a kind of traveling way and all these sort of things. And it's non-committal. It's just sort of, I'm here if you want to tap into any thoughts I may have. And well, what a great resource to be able to tap into, you'd have thought.
Absolutely.
And it is interesting now that David Witt is available as a coach. Like, and you know, obviously very successful stint with Pegula. I think Tom Hill, it will be interesting. He's much younger, isn't he? Like, that felt like, you know, he obviously had that relationship with Sakkari, but, you know, how will that transfer to other players? But I think David Witt feels like he is now on the market for someone to take him as a coach, and he's shown, you know, incredible loyalty to his two players, really, Venus Williams and Jessica Pegula. But like, he's done really good things, so it would be interesting to see if Sakkari goes there. I have no idea.
And in other Greek news, it feels a long time, sorry to do this to you, Matt, but it feels a very long time ago that you were making a big Greek prediction, doesn't it?
Because never going to live that one down.
In the same week that the Sakkari Tom Hill split news came out, Stefanos Tsitsipas has dropped out of the world's top 10 for the first time since 2019. And this means that there is no single-handed backhand in the ATP top 10 for the first time ever.
Which is wild.
What's bigger, Tsitsipas dropping out of the top 10 or there being no single-hander?
I mean, for tennis as a whole, I think the fact that there's no single-hander,
It should
51 years.
Should perhaps be noted that there was a world in which Dimitrov entered the top 10 this week, wasn't there? Like, we were only, I think, match away.
That was a lot for Grigor, wasn't it? Like, the whole of the single-handed backhand community is resting on your shoulders.
He was part of a band called the One-Handed Backhand Boys.
Oh, God, he was. He doesn't need more pressure.
Yeah.
But, yeah, we were...
The future of this shot is in your hands.
We were one Grigor Dimitrov win away, I think, from Matt's tremendous newsletter stat this week, not being a thing.
Sort of. Mine's about year-end top tens.
Okay.
So we're not there
yet. So it
would
still have worked.
And the thing about Tsitsipas is that, like, absolutely incredible streak he's had of being consistent in the top 10. I think we can overlook that, but that's a long time of consistency. And yet, it feels like he's he's so good that he shouldn't be falling outside of the top 10. Like, it does, it feels like something's gone dramatically wrong for him to be in this position. And as we know, like, it hasn't been a good year. And I suppose the one-handed backhand thing is like, this is the tipping point of, this has been coming for years. Like, it goes down the levels, doesn't it? People are no longer coaching the one-handed backhand quite so much as the two-hander. And there are so many more advantages in the modern game of the two-handed backhand. We've seen it in the women's game, you know, that the one-handed backhand is almost non-existent now at the top of the sport. And yeah, there aren't that many young players with one-handed backhands. Like, perhaps it's resting on Denis Shapovalov and Lorenzo Musetti, in which case,
well,
might be in trouble. But like,
I wish listeners could see the face that Matt just did in that pause.
He did those grinding teeth emoji.
I know that.
But I do think Tsitsipas will probably get back in the top 10.
I did ask Tim Henman whether he would coach any young player now to have a one-handed backhand. He said absolutely not.
And I think Federer has said the same. Saying that.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Nails in coffins. Other couple of bits of news. Australian Open is considering a Sunday women's final. That is, that's Billie Jean just mounting David there. Those are the sounds you can hear. The ITIA has reduced the suspension period of Jensen Brooksby to 13 months. It was previously at 18 months. That's due to new information. So his suspension will end on March the 3rd, 2024. And Simona Halep has had her hearing, hasn't she? And we await the news from that. In terms of the men's events this week, as I said, the women are in Dubai. The men are in Rio with the, as Matt was saying, the same field as they had in Buenos Aires pretty much last week. They're also in Doha, 250 event there. Nadal is out. He had planned to play in Doha. He's out, but he hopes to be ready for Indian Wells. You've also got Rublev, Khachanov, Bublik and Andy Murray playing in Doha. And we've got ATP Los Cabos this week as well, with Tsitsipas, Zverev, Dimonor, Casper Ruud, Jack Draper and Dan Evans playing, possibility of a Draper-Evans second round.
Ooh.
Yeah, big yes please to that. And that's your lot for this week in the tennis world, except to tell you about our mascot, Bowie, or potentially Bowie. And I think both are true. Do you say Bowie or Bowie?
That's a very good question. That's very Shrewsbury, isn't it? I've always said David Bowie.
I say
me
Bowie.
Too. Okay, great. Let's go Bowie. Bowie is owned by Heather Day. Bowie's a rescue, and honest thieves. I know you say every week, I say, oh, that's a nice dog, but this is a really, really lovely dog. Bowie's mum was rescued in Texas when she was pregnant, and soon after she had 12 puppies. Thoughts and prayers with Bowie's mum. Bowie and three other puppies were flown to Seattle to be adopted in the summer of 2021 when they were 10 weeks old. He's very much a pandemic-inspired adoption. I feel you, Heather. I've got a pandemic-inspired adoption currently flirting with David to my left.
And they're all great.
He's a much-needed companion to Henry, our only child, says Heather, who was 6 years old and had begged us for a dog forever. Bowie is part lab, part red heeler, which gives him his lovely freckles. He's clever, takes the lead on walks, he knows where he wants to go, loves treats and playing with other dogs, and Henry is his best friend, and that is absolutely lovely. He is beautiful. What a good boy. And I will pop a picture of him on our Instagram, and Matt will pop in our newsletter. And do subscribe to the newsletter. Matt's stat this week is a belter. We have our mascots. I have the dearly departed Darwin, and my plan for this week was to go for guaranteed points in honour and memory of Darwin. So I went for Carlos Alcaraz to win Buenos Aires, and obviously I was tremendously let down by both Carlos Alcaraz and Nicholas Jarry. But as in the words of Matt on the WhatsApp group, maybe that is actually an even more fitting tribute to Darwin, to try and fail to get points. So there we are. Sorry about that. David has Francis. And Matt has Haider and Soma. Billie Jean is really living her best life right now. She's sponsored by Billie Jean King and Ilana Kloss. We have top folks and executive producers, and they are Greg, Chris, Jamie and Jeff. And Matt, we have shout outs.
We have Rachel Knowlton in Ipswich, Massachusetts.
Hi, Rachel.
Hello, Rachel. There's another Ipswich.
My thoughts exactly.
Wow.
I think
I was just about to say home of the Tractor Boys, but no. Well, Matt and I have driven through Massachusetts.
Yep. And Rachel, Catherine, has a Bernese Mountain Dog.
Rachel.
That we named Rafa, she says.
Oh. Send pictures, Rachel. Send pictures urgently. Thank you very much.
We've also got Jasper Vandendriescher.
Hello.
Jasper says, I bet Catherine will be the best one to pronounce my family name since she is an expert in pronouncing Dutch names.
I was going to say, in our Rotterdam review show as well. How perfect.
Although actually Jasper is from Brussels in Belgium.
Okay, so Flemish.
Yes.
Okay. Jasper, could I hear it again, please, Matt?
Jasper. Vandendriescher. Is my attempt.
Vandendriescher. That's what I'm going for. It was a bit German, wasn't it?
Sounded quite good, really.
That's what I'm going for. Thank you, Jasper.
And finally, we have Layla.
Layla.
And no, I'm not going to sing. But it might be the Layla.
Wow.
Because all we've got is this
Layla,
spelling.
You got no,
all we've
leave,
got is Layla.
Please.
But it is different spelling. But I think we had that before. There was a whole spelling situation.
Matt looks really panicked right now. Matt is the look of a man who's worried someone's going to make him sing. Layla, thank you ever so much. You've given us an excuse to dig out the incredible edit.
Backer number 262.
Just Layla.
Just right, Layla. Like the song. No, not like the song. Spelled differently.
Thanks, Layla. What song's that? Sing it.
Is it
You think you've Lila? You think you've Lila by Oasis?
No, no.
Layla, you got me on my knees, Layla.
Oh yes.
It's the first time I've ever heard Matt sing.
It is. What a note to finish on.
Oh God.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.